Hello, everybody, and welcome to the School of Life podcast. My name is Jenna Hayes, one of the hosts.
And my name's Amira David. I'm your other host.
So we're so stoked to be able to offer this podcast. The real beauty behind and the purpose for doing this podcast is that Amira and I are dear friends, and for months and months now, we've had this idea, sort of a dream, if you will, but you know, what if we started a podcast really just to bring others into this really fun process that her and I have just in our friendship, which is that we are just students of life. We're students of culture and students of ideas. Amira and I, on a regular basis, find ourselves just in long conversations, sometimes short conversations, but all just dissecting ideas together and sending each other quotes and reading material together and just sifting through books and podcasts. And the sort of the summary of that has just been, wow, we are humanity. We are all just students of life, you know, and it is just this school that we're in, is that oftentimes we are students of our own inputs, you know, the things that we intentionally read or study, and then otherwise, sometimes just circumstances and things that happen to us are their own teacher, their own school. And so the intention today and going forward is just that we just start having more of a public discussion that her and I otherwise just do privately all the time. And so for her and I, these are ideas and concepts that we really, really love to study. Maybe we're a little bit nerdy, but maybe some of you can relate to some of this. So yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing this thing called a rest retreat every few months, if we can, where by some miracle we find a way to carve out a weekend together away from our families, where we really just rest primarily. And what actually ends up happening is we end up talking for like 36 hours at a time, and resting in between. We even take a nap every once in a while, and we read each other things out of the books that we're reading alongside each other. And out of those periods of rest that have been so potent and valuable have come some of the most incredible transformative ideas and motivations and inspirations for what to do next in our families, what to do next with our children, what to do next in our marriages, and ultimately also what to do next just together.
Yeah.
And so that was also what has come from those rest retreats, and that we've realized how actually productive rest actually is and can be, because it's a time to stop and listen and to make sense of all the doing.
Yeah.
We have to actually stop and be.
Yeah. Super life-giving.
So life-giving, and something that is really hard to make happen. And we've seen the value in it and how transformative it actually is. So this podcast came out of rest, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, it's so cool.
And what she said in terms of like our conversations, we've just realized how passionate we are and how juicy and lovely our conversations are. So we just really want to offer you to come to the table with us and participate in what we like to talk about.
Yeah.
And so what we're offering is just what we have. Yeah. We are not scholars by any stretch of the imagination, although we like to read a lot and listen to a lot. But what we have is our experience. What we have is what we're passionate about, just like anyone else in the world.
Yeah.
And so we offer this to you from a really humble place of just wanting to give what stokes us.
Yeah, totally. So a lot of what we'll be discussing is really, in a, to put it really simply, is to discuss worldview. And that is kind of a maybe a loaded word, or maybe sort of an under... I don't know, it's maybe sort of flies under the radar, but the idea of worldview is really just the way that, like a lens through which different people view the world. Oftentimes it's just different reading of the same data points. It can be sort of a mental map through which you view the world, and everybody has one. And whether it's, you know, fully examined or not, it's just, you know, we all come to the table with different worldviews. And so part of the process here is just to be sort of examining different ideas, you know, and different worldviews.
Yeah. So we kind of, we're playing with this working mission statement that right now goes something like taking a deeper look at the popular ideas of our day and their logical implications, tested alongside an examined biblical worldview. So we want to be really transparent about where we're coming from. And to that end, I think we're going to take a minute to just sort of further introduce ourselves.
Yeah.
And where we're both coming from, so we can ground this in our humanity and why our lives have brought us here. Take it away, Jenna.
Yeah, so I'm Jenna Hayes, and I am, I'm a wife and mother of three kiddos under the age of 8. So those are my primary and favorite parts of myself, is my family. Outside of that, I do a couple different things, but I, in terms of hobbies, I just really like to read and be alone. That's super weird, but I actually just really love to, I love to study all sorts of things. I am founder and president of an organization, a nonprofit, called the Pearl Projects, which really has the mission of just kind of designing and implementing discipleship-rich resources. So coming from a Christian worldview, it's kind of building out and creating resources and tools specifically for women. I just love relating to women and our stories. And so it's kind of from that place that that organization was built. And then otherwise, I've been really involved in Oregon, sort of working towards developing some education alternatives in public education. And most recently, kind of developing a privatized Christian school. And so I'm kind of in the full throes of that process right now. I've got my own podcast outside of this called The Pearlcast, that's specifically just kind of touching on more political issues, specific social and political issues. But here, I just love to be with my friend Amira. This is, you know, all of those things circling in who I am, but the core of who I am is this deep trust in and relationship with the God of the Bible. And I think that has become a really sweet shared experience and value between Amira and I, and is really the foundation of our friendship. And so from that, these rest retreats have come, and this really beautiful and deep relationship that we have. So we're just really grateful to bring you all into that. And so here, I'll let Amira share a bit about who she is here too.
Yeah. So my name's Amira David. By day I work as a counselor, a mental health therapist. I started doing this back in 2012, which is really hard to believe that it's been almost 12 years. And that has taken many different forms, from working in high schools to different agencies to working with children. And now I primarily see clients who are in the postpartum period of their life. A lot of new parents really struggling in the adjustment to parenthood and motherhood and fatherhood. Also I have two kids, they're 9 and almost 6. I'm also a wife. We both live near and in Ashland, Oregon. My life really changed about 4 years ago. And I won't get into the whole story, but basically everything sort of turned upside down when, God just took me by the collar and was like, here we go. I ended up sitting into this church I didn't know was a church, and ended up weeping all the way home afterwards and having no idea why. and proceeded to go to church every Sunday for the next 4 months in secret. Not a single person my entire life knew. And I would cry all the way home every single time. And it was really one of the first times that I couldn't intellectualize what was happening, but it was an experience of sorts that that was totally and completely outside of my control and my understanding. And otherly.
Yeah.
And all that I can say is that from that moment, it has been as if the Lord has sort of opened this fire hose of information, mm-hmm. where it's sort of this like insatiable desire for me to know more.
Yeah.
And I historically, you know, I'm coming from a community and upbringing that was mostly rooted in the New Age ideology and in more of a mystic Eastern religion ideology. And so for me, when I was growing up, the word Christian was more or less kind of a bad word. And so that is, you know, I'm coming from a history where I straight up judged Christianity for lots of reasons. And here I am finding myself identifying as such. So life is a trip and it takes you places you never imagined. And now I'm having to relearn how to be human, how to do my work, how to be a mom, how to be a wife, how to be a human. Relearning basically like right and wrong and everything under the sun. So I have been in this process of examining life and examining my own worldview pretty intensely for 4.5 years now. Mm-hmm. And I've read more books in the last 4.5 years than I probably ever did in college or graduate school, yeah. actually. Yeah. And that's kind of miraculous because I have no time.
Right.
So it's really like, I think by the grace of God that I'm like functioning during the day because I read late at night and, it's been wild and beautiful and life transforming and also really hard.
Yeah.
Because to be frank, you know, I do exist in a family and a culture and a community where I am definitely the minority now, and experiencing what that is like and navigating it it's a very complex reality that I live in now, to just put it simply.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. So Amira and I have a little bit of like an inverted history. It's really interesting. So we grew up in the same town. I grew up sort of out in the woods, out in the mountains, but came into Ashland for public school, and Amira and I both went to the same public schools and, Ashland High School. So for her, you know how she mentioned that Christianity was like a bad word, or Christians, you know, that whole idea. And for me, I grew up in a Christian home, so different than her. But I felt that same sense of reality as a younger Christian, in that I always sensed that who I was a bad word in my town. And I knew that my worldview was definite minority, and I knew very, very few people in our city in Ashland who thought like me. And so I just kind of kept who I was very like hidden, and maybe not hidden, but just like I just kind of kept to myself about all that, and tried my best to like figure out and navigate life despite having really contrary values to, I would say, an average friend, you know, or an average student, you know, side by side in school or something like that. And so anyway, what that landed me in is, so 6 years into college, was that I found myself really confronting a lot of you know, the big questions that all of us inevitably end up asking at different times in our lives. But I felt like the childhood faith that I had really was not cutting it for the intellectual rigor that was required of me in college when confronted, especially in like philosophy classes, when confronted with some of the prevailing or more dominant worldviews, certainly that exist in higher education. And so that, it's not that I had a crisis of faith. I'm not sure that's accurate to say, but it definitely set me off on this same trajectory of asking bigger questions. And really chasing down logic and reason from this place of, is it possible actually to be a logical and reason filled Christian? Is that, mm-hmm. or is that an oxymoron? Like, what is that, you know? And so, so while Amir and I came to this new place of like this hunger, it's almost like a starvation for more, like this insatiable desire to learn more. We came to that place for different reasons, but it's in that exact, like intersection for both her and I, where we have, where we're at now, where it's, wow, actually, there is a lot more to the story. There's a lot more. And in terms of the School of Life name, what we have found, what both of our experiences, although so different, what both of our experiences have taught us is that much of the prevailing things, for example, that we learn in school, as I'm sure many of you can relate to this too, as you get older, it turns out, oh, actually some of those things weren't actually true in all cases or helpful in different ways. And so being an adult learner and a lifelong learner has been really fun because it's just created all these extra questions. And so, but they're a joy. And so we have just in our friendship and just alone really plugged in. And so that's, I think, yeah, kind of where we find ourselves in friendship, but also in these, you know, really starkly different backgrounds, but now in this real place of intersection and commonality that has been really precious in a friendship. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And I just want to add to that, that also I can speak for myself, but I think this might be true for you too, is that it's been a really humbling process.
Totally. Yeah.
For me to, because when I, for the last 4 years, have been investigating a specifically biblical worldview, the backdrop of that for me, and I think the reason it's been so intensive, is because I knew right out the gate that I had to know if it was worth risking everything I know.
Yeah.
Worth risking my marriage, my family, my friendships, my job. Because, you know, if you don't know, Ashland is a town where it's less acceptable to be Christian, mm-hmm. I guess, if I would put it blatantly.
Yeah, very, very spiritual city, but yes. Not the favor if you are, if you're a more Christian-leaning person. Yeah.
Yeah. So we come to this examination from a place of having, like, dove really deep and assessed a lot of risk along the way well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think part of the driving motivation, at least I know that Amir and I share this, but is really that this desire to ascertain like coherence in the assertions that we have in our life or like the assumptions that we have. We want a coherent worldview. We want to make sure that, you know, the things that we are thinking about and believing actually logically link up, mm-hmm. and that it has a really full orbed, I guess cohesive really is the best word. We want a cohesive worldview that aligns best with reality as we actually experience it. And so, yeah, it's really from that place that we dive in here.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I want to just speak a little bit more to this word worldview, because I know that it might not be something that we all have used often. And it's really like a story. So we all want to make sure that we have the right story. I mean, we live our lives by story. This is how we have always learned best, is actually through story, down through history and through the generations. Mm-hmm. And the stories we tell ourselves, we often arrive at in largely unexamined ways. And yet we still need a story to feel safe and okay in the world, and to make sense of all that the world would otherwise feel like chaos, really. And also I feel this in a really acute way, like raising my kids. Sometimes it can feel to me a little bit like life and death. Like, I want to make sure that I have the right story to make sure that they have what they need to function and flourish in the world. And I think this is probably true for all of us, that we're coming from this foundation of wanting to offer our children, we want to do right by them and make sure they have what they need to be okay in the world. Mm-hmm. No matter who we are, no matter what worldview we're coming from, I think that's something that really unites us, that we all share.
Totally.
Yeah. You want to say anything more about that?
I think that it is, for me, for sure, the point at which you start raising children is a really, like, it really confronts, actually, your deeply held values. Because, you know, it's, I don't know, it's kind of one of those things, like, all my life, I have taken for granted the idea of, like, that, you know, that I feel like that I believe God loves me and that I have a purpose. And so I tell my kids those things. But then I've also asked myself the question, what if I didn't think that? How would I rationalize to my kids that their lives have meaning or that they have purpose and human dignity, you know, those sorts of things. And so, like, in raising kids, these ideas have come up a lot more where it's like, wow, if I didn't have these assumptions, where would I get the standards for those, you know? And so it's been a really fun, raising kids has been a fun opportunity to really test out what we believe and why, mm-hmm. and how to hand that off.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's also really amazing, and maybe we take it for granted, this notion that we actually need meaning.
Mm, yeah, totally.
It makes me think of Viktor Frankl, The Man's Search for Meaning. He was at Auschwitz, and he discovered that the people who survived best and the most were the ones who had a deeper meaning and made meaning of what was happening to them, and that was this thread that pulled them through. I want to read a few quotes from one of our favorite authors on the planet. Her name is Nancy Piercy. If you've never heard of her, she is brilliant, and please find her books.
Yeah, yeah. We're just over here, total girl, raving girl fans here.
So these are quotes from a book called Finding Truth. Okay, so this first one is, humans have a tendency to look to some power or principle or person to make sense of life and give it meaning. So I think that that's a given. Right. If we really think on our lives, that's what we do. Mm-hmm. Then she goes on to say, the biblical view of human nature implies that we are, quote, and this is a quote from Albert Walters, incapable of holding purely arbitrary opinions or making entirely unprincipled decisions. We need some creed to live by, some map by which to chart our course. Mm. So we think of worldview really as like a map.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
Otherwise, we're just out here floating in the universe and would be otherwise probably paralyzed. Mm-hmm. So here's my favorite one in this thread. So Nancy Piercy goes on to say, everyone believes something in the sense that they must assume that some principle is fundamentally true. So later we'll get into this notion of truth. It is impossible to think without a starting point. If you press any set of ideas back far enough, eventually you reach an ultimate starting point, something that is taken as the self-existent reality on which everything depends. This starting assumption cannot be based on prior reasoning, because if it were, you could ask where that reasoning starts, and so on in infinite regress. If starting premises do not rest on reasons, how can they be tested? Although you cannot argue backward to their prior reasons, you can argue forward by spelling out their implications, then testing those implications using logic and experience. And I think that's a really important thing also, is that we're using logic and experience, and they are both valuable ways of knowing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So I know that was a lot of words, but basically what she's getting at here is that we all have starting assumptions about the world, whether we know it or not, actually.
Yeah.
And that at the very fundamental level, at the starting point, in any worldview, any way of thinking about the world, we're starting from often equal and opposite assumptions.
Yeah.
Like, for example, we're starting from the assumption that there is a God, or the equal and opposite assumption that there is not a God.
Yeah.
As one example of that.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that we have been learning, I think, in the deeper dive in philosophy, especially as it pertains to worldview, is that many of sort of the more popular, you know, prevailing worldviews are really promoted as unbiased and rational, as if they are unaffected by philosophical assumptions. To put it kind of simply, it's like the idea that there is such thing as neutral knowledge. But really the idea is that every single, the uncaused cause, you know, the origin point that all the worldviews, differ on or have different, ideas about, really all of those start with an assumption. Every single idea, that claims itself as a worldview, when stripped back, begins with certain assumptions. And those assumptions then determine the whole trajectory of the worldview and all of its implications. Mm-hmm. So it turns out worldview actually is fairly weighty just in terms of its implications and ideas.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I want to add to that that we, I know this also from experience as a counselor, that our worldview really matters because it actually is the origin point of all of our, you know, our mental state, our emotional state, the decisions we make, the behaviors we do, the priorities we have,
processes of reasoning,
yes, the value we place on anything, the things we take for granted, the things that we, you know, think are most important. The ways that we decide, you know, how to chart the course of our life. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is like the most important thing is what determines those things. And that actually happens to be this starting point.
Yeah. Yeah. So good.
So I think in the next episode, we're going to go deeper into even just this notion of truth, but we're going to start in a different place today. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Let's do it. So today we're going to start with this idea that, there's a problem.
Yeah.
Basically. And, so every worldview also has to contend with certain questions. Mm-hmm. Among them are, answering the question of what is wrong and how do we know that there's a problem when it's always been this way, or we think it's always been this way.
So the idea of a problem in the world, like what's wrong when like all of us sense, just like at a street level, at a sensory level, like that something is not quite right, that there are things that are amiss. Yeah, the larger problem.
And why do we think this if it has always been this way? Mm-hmm. And objectively, I think we can say, you know, things have always been not quite right in the world. Mm-hmm. So we want to ask the question, like, how do we gauge where we're at as a humanity and as a society specifically? And how do we gauge what we need? So every worldview has to have an answer to what's wrong and what is needed to make it right. What's the solution?
Totally.
And we know this in medicine and even in mental health. We have to have an accurate diagnosis in order to find an accurate or fitting cure. Mm-hmm. And so in this podcast in general, we're going to be looking at what are the solutions on offer, basically. Mm-hmm. What are the worldviews that are on offer? What are the solutions to the problem on offer? Yeah. And what do we do in our culture as a response to what's wrong? And everyone has a story about what is wrong and how to fix it. Mm-hmm. So to begin with, we want to just first look at what are the symptoms? So when you go into a doctor, they look at your symptoms. When you go into someone like me, a mental health therapist, I ask, like, what are you experiencing? Yeah. What are your symptoms?
Yeah.
So we can have a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one way that we historically have measured how well we're doing as a society, and I think we've all heard of the term, you know, GDP, right? This has been a standard of metric, a standard metric of economic growth called the gross domestic product. It merely measures the size of a nation's economy and doesn't reflect a nation's welfare necessarily. The modern conception of GDP was actually, and I didn't know this before, it was a product of war. It was developed by John Maynard, Keynes? During the Second World War in Britain. It's a measure created to assess wartime production capabilities of a nation, and it has obvious drawbacks in peacetime. For one, GDP by definition is an aggregate measure that includes the value of goods and services produced in an economy over a certain period of time. There is no scope for the positive or negative effects created in the process of production and development. A rising inequality is resulting in a rise in societal discontent and increased polarization. This is from the Harvard Business Review. So out of that, you know, a lot of people are going like, well, okay, that measures one very specific thing, but it doesn't actually look at how well we're doing in by other metrics. So there's something else called the Social Progress Index. And this has been developed by an organization that has partners covering 47 countries. And so there's a lot of people trying to figure out a different way to measure how we're doing. And in this one, they're looking at basic human needs, such as food and water and security, looking at those as sort of the foundations of well-being, also looking at education, access to information, access to healthcare, and a sustainable environment, and also looking at opportunities for citizens to achieve their goals and ambitions. So this is better. I would say this looks a little bit deeper into how we're really doing. But ultimately, I would argue that this still doesn't look at the actual inner world of humans. Yeah. So we can be fed and housed and even educated and even have access to, you know, ways of meeting our goals and working, but still be depressed and anxious and without ultimate meaning. Do you want to say anything about that?
No, I mean, no, not right now.
Okay. So we want to look at what's actually happening in our inner world, because I would argue that that is our lived experience, is how we're internally doing, you know? And that's what matters to most people. In fact, I recently heard an interview with someone who's starting to create these new sort of schools that's a deviation from like the public school system. And he interviewed, I don't even know, like 1,000 parents or something, or a lot of parents, asking them what matters most to them once their children have graduated from high school. And ironically, none of them, or almost none of them, cited anything having to do with academics. That they really wanted their children to have a sense of meaning, a sense of agency, a sense of well-being, to be able to function well with others, to be able to love and be loved. You know, this is what matters to us as parents. And, you know, this is, I just thought it was a really interesting indication of what matters, right? So, as a mental health therapist, I have my own experiences of what I see in my practice and the trends that exist there. But I went to look at some studies of what's actually happening on a grander scale, and was actually, I mean, I knew it was bad, but I didn't know how bad. so this was, this actually came as a bit of a shock to me, even though I'm in this field. So I'm just going to spend a few minutes here giving you a picture of what's happening on the inner world of the people today. And a lot of these statistics will have to do with our young people, with teens, because I think they're a bit of like the canary in the coal mine that show us better how we're really doing, because they're at the mercy of so much. So there was a study done by CNN, and they got some of their stats from CDC estimations. In 2019, 13% of teens had a major depressive episode, up 60% from 2007. suicide rates from the ages 10 to 24 went up 60% in that same period of time. 60%. Along with from 2015 to 2019, so that was only 4 years, and this is before the pandemic, mind you, prescriptions for mental health medication increased almost 40% for teens. Wow. So teens are a good litmus test for how we're doing. Mm-hmm. Matt Richtel, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning author, wrote Life or Death, The Mental Health Crisis Among U.S. Teens. He spent a year interviewing teens and their families, and he found that the risk to teens has flipped from external harms to internalized risks. So we used to think of this, you know, we would send our kids out and be worried about them going to a kegger or something, and that was the risk, right? But now the risk is anxiety, depression, suicide, and self-harm. Yeah. That's the pervasive risk that we face with our teens today, which is far scarier. Yeah. So he was asking the question, why? There are change in the adolescent brain that they're finding and changes in the environment, and both these have collided into serious pathology. So actually things that are down are things like vaping or alcohol or sex or like a lot of TV. Those things are actually slightly down. But, and these are, again, some pre-pandemic stats, and I'll go into after pandemic in a moment here, but what is way up actually is persistent hopelessness, considering suicide, planning suicide, attempting suicide, and the use of smartphones, which is, at that point, it was an average of 3 hours a day. I recently also looked at a study that said that screen time for teens is an average, get this, 9 hours a day.
What?
9 hours a day, which is absolutely insane. I mean, that's like the whole day, yeah, basically. There has also been a lifestyle shift from congregating with friends outside and doing things to now spending more time inside, less sleep because people are on their phones till late at night, online more and more stagnant and more isolated. So the issue, I mean, it's quite nuanced. We can't just pin this on like, oh, it's social media. Because for some kids, social media can be good and help them stay connected and get information and things like that. But it also has a very distinct role that it has played in this mental health crisis.
Yeah.
So let's see. So now looking a little bit into adults as well. According to the CNN and KFF poll, about half of adults say they have had a severe mental health crisis in their family, including in-person treatment for family members. Okay, so here's what's really interesting. The vast majority in this one study said more than 4 out of 5 of those surveyed, which is over 2,000 people, say individuals and families should play a major role in addressing mental health problems in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So Jenna's going to get into this later, about the essential role of family in the formation of humans, yeah, and flourishing. But I just wanted to note that because somehow we know that family should help mitigate mental health.
Yeah.
And that's a really important thing. So hold on to that. Okay. So I need to prioritize. I have so much information here. I think what I'm going to go into now, is how things got worse after or during COVID. Okay, so the CDC reported also that during the pandemic, okay, this is insane, 29% of U.S. high school students had a parent or caregiver who lost their job, and this is what blew my freaking mind. 55% were emotionally abused by a parent or caregiver, and 11% were physically abused, okay? So that's 55, I mean, more than half of teens were emotionally abused by a parent or caregiver during the pandemic, which is absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to go on. Biology is also playing a role in this. For whatever reason, the age of puberty is dropping and has been dropping for decades, especially in girls, which is likely leading to difficulty processing complex feelings and knowing what to do about them. And also, these developmental changes drive young people to seek attention and approval from their peers. For some, using social media fulfills that need in a healthy way while, you know, providing opportunities for connection. But for others, it's really detrimental because the comparisons are there, the bullying is nonstop. There's this sort of dehumanization that occurs. And social media is engineered for engagement. And so people are losing their lives to this. I think it's the only socially acceptable addiction that we have. Yes. And we all know it's an addiction, really. And I can't tell you how many clients I sit with in my office who come to me of all ages and are desperate to find a way out, but they cannot find a way out. Because most of our social engagement now occurs within the context of social media, as well as our news, as well as political, you know, campaign. I mean, all of it is tied in now, so we can't go back.
It's the one-stop shop for all the
things. We can't. It's the Pandora's box that has been opened that we cannot take back. Yeah. And as an aside, AI is the next version of that Pandora's box that we won't be able to take back. Yeah. And we don't have safeguards in place if it should go awry, which it will. But we'll get into that in
another episode.
So I'm gonna move down here. A few more stats, just to really paint this picture. There's these stressors that are going, I mean, we can look at structural factors that affect millions of people in the U.S. today, including poverty, food insecurity, homelessness, lack of access to healthcare and mental health care and educational opportunities. These can lead to a stress response patterns, that are known to underlie mental health challenges. So when it's like the baseline for our stress has sort of been bumped up, especially after the pandemic, I noticed. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as a therapist, I get more calls now than I ever did before, because of that sort of global increase in our stress response and our anxiety.
Yeah.
Even in very young children, prolonged stress can trigger a cycle of emotion regulation problems, which can in turn lead to anxiety and depression and behavior difficulties. These things are just really well established, but we're not doing enough as a field to address them at all. Okay, a few last stats for you. Here we go. In late June, this was in 2020, 40% of U.S. adults reported struggling with mental health or substance use. Half of all lifetime mental illness begins by the age of 14. So that's really young. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among people aged 10 to 34 in the U.S.
Gosh.
Okay, that's really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
More than 70% of youth in the juvenile justice system have a diagnosed mental illness. The most common mental illness in the U.S. are anxiety disorders, which affect 40 million adults, which is 18% of the population. But I will mention here, transgenderism was declassified as an anxiety disorder. So the numbers are actually probably quite higher.
Much higher.
Yeah. Okay, the last thing I'm going to read here in this category, this is from the Barna study in 2019. Just one in three 18 to 35-year-old respondents shared with Barna that they often felt deeply, only one in three said they often felt deeply cared for by those around them. Or that someone believed in them. Meanwhile, nearly one in four acknowledged encountering feelings of loneliness and isolation. When respondents had an opportunity to provide a portrait of their emotions, the image was one of a generation gripped by worry. Anxiety about important decisions was widespread in the connected generation, 40%, as well as uncertainty about the future, fear of failure, and pressure to be successful. So this is a quote from Jefferson Bethke, who's an author, speaker, and podcaster. He says, our generation has a huge amount of difficulty because we're trying to get meaning from a smaller select group of things. And here we go. Realistically, the promise the world is giving us in a consumeristic mentality is an individual dream or promise. This meaning or connection you get from the neighborhood or the meaning or connection you get from your neighborhood, your family, from living in one location your whole life, from religion, etc. All these things that really anchor you are starting to go away. one by one.
Yeah.
So, okay, that was a lot of information. I could go for another 3 hours with the amount of information I have that I'm having to sift through right now. But that just gives you a little bit of a window into what's going on. And I'll speak more to my own experience in therapy later. But this is a good segue into what Jenna has for you about our history and those things that are going away.
Yeah. Yeah. So here we just kind of wanted, so while we're stating, okay, that these might be the facts of what we're really facing, especially here in the West. So if these are our statistics, what do we make of that? Like, what do we make of those? And I mean, it feels deeply intuitive at this point to say something like the statement, what we are doing is not working. Whatever that thing is, whatever, or multiple things, what we're doing is not working. And so then that begs a multitude of other questions. Well, what in former generations, at least this is where my mind goes, is what did former generations do in time periods in history that were, by all of the metrics, especially that you just mentioned, were far worse in terms of like the needs, like the basic human needs in many civilizations and time periods not being met, certainly not in the way that they are met for us here in the West in terms of availability of healthcare, mental health care, food and shelter, and just like some of the basics. So it's like, how come in past generations there was, it seems like, a different coping ability amidst chaos, stress, war, and all sorts of much more severe, if I might say, conditions, like living conditions and cultural conditions. So anyway, this kind of, I have written a book on spiritual formation, but in doing so, I was able to kind of dive into asking that those questions, what were the formation factors of past generations that really helped to shape the inner world of people so that then whatever they are facing, they're facing it with this inner compass that has been formed within them. And so we know just by observation that often you'll see people who fare and endure storms well, storms of life, you know, well, and others who don't fare as well. So then it's like, what are the factors? What are the variables there? So here we're looking at, what are the formation factors? What have shaped people in the past? What has shaped character and an inner compass or virtue? What have been the formation factors that have created meaning in the lives of former generations? How did they arrive at those things? So core assumptions there, how did they arrive at the core assumptions? What were some of the shared values and how did those affect the way that they engaged their world and complexities that they face in the world? So it's to ask the question, what forms any person then at any point in history? So one of the factors is the time period, the context in which we're born. During, you know, in thinking about a context, it's, well, what technologies were available in that context and what ideas were prevailing at that time. The next variable would be worldview. So the ideology, the mental map of any one culture or tribe, the philosophies and the assumptions. Generally, worldview is handed down from family of origin. So that's where you would obtain your values and your understanding of morality, and also with that, your obligations. Next is relationships. So like we know that I've heard different studies, but your closest, roughly 6 to 8 closest relationships, at least in former generations, used to be your family, would really form your commitments based on tradition and those values. And then lastly, just in terms of just the neuroscience, is that our habits are deeply formative. The disciplines that are imparted to us from our families of origin, also having to do with our commitments and tradition and our obligations. So what we're really talking about are social institutions. So first and foremost would be marriage. And marriage, we know throughout all of history, was part of all cultures for all of time. And really, it's the foundation of social life. As a Christian, we believe that, you know, marriage as an institution is part of the created order, ontologically then real and good. So in part of that, the marriage kind of sets out the moral requirements that, you know, that are made are not impositions necessarily on our freedom, but rather are expressions of our true nature. And so in the context of marriage then is family. And so the assumption there is that relationships are part of the created order and they are civilizing institutions, therefore. So family, things, institutions like church and state, but meaning just religions of the past and traditions of the past. And then the state as a formative factor and society as a formative factor. And all of these have their own interpretations and definitions of what the common good is. So assumptions there. And then all fulfill our social nature and develop moral virtues, depending on the tradition and culture. Those differ, but in general, these are the formative factors that prepare us for our ultimate purpose. And so depending on the, you know, the different way that you experience those factors really determines the outcome of the person. So in terms of relationships, relationships in the context of those institutions have always been understood as anchors, biological bonds of family, the moral bonds of marriage, the spiritual bonds of the within the church, and then the genetic bonds of clan and race as understood in former generations. So the impartation of values and tradition, that was the primary context through which all of that, those things were imparted. So like in an agrarian society, you know, say 100 years ago in general, and of course, for sure, prior to the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, kids were apprenticing under their parents and working with their parents in the parents' trades. And so spending significant time with their parents every day, as opposed to, you know, 8 hours locked in a classroom in school all day. And so there's all sorts of varying factors for different cultures over time. But the main point of saying all this is that worldview is the result of those formation factors. And that's also the place where meaning and where purpose is come to be understood. And it's just really, just interesting because, you know, in former generations, it does seem that there was a higher threshold for pain, whereas we have and I just mean pain, like cultural complexity and stress, and there was just a higher threshold for it and an adaptation to difficulty. And so we know intuitively now there is a low threshold for pain here, which is in the United States, and for complexity and for stress. And so that for me to connect the dots there, whether it's causal or whether it's just sort of one implication of it, is that we are failing at least our young people in their ability to cope well. We are not doing a good job in helping children to understand, you know, how to adapt and how to endure and to weather storms. And so without that that groundwork, this firm foundation in terms of worldview for children to be able to, to assess and evaluate and direct our lives based on an inner compass, it just leaves this gap. It leaves this chasm really between people's ability to encounter life as it actually occurs for them and to cope well. So there's a whole bunch more to that, but I mean, I think at a minimum, we just want to say, yeah, it feels like the common, maybe the air we breathe right now, which is sort of a popular dominant way of thinking in the West, at least, is that of secularism. And so it's sort of not the perspective that Amira and I come to the table with here, but it's like something is not working. And so hopefully we're just sort of painting the picture here of that something's not working. We're not claiming we have all the answers, but we do think that we, in terms of history, we have altered course, and the alteration here is not proving to be progress as understood by the metrics that we would hope. So if our young people are not faring well and the average adults are not faring well, despite all of our increased technology, all of our beautiful progress in all sorts of other ways, it turns out that the inner person, the inner life of the mind and the heart and the soul, are somehow deeply neglected, at least in terms of shaping the inner world to be able to adapt and cope and thrive, actually. Not just cope, but to thrive amidst some complexity, but comparatively speaking, it's just an interesting cultural moment to be human and certainly to be raising children.
Yeah. One little aside I want to throw in here, and also a plug for Nancy Piercy's new book, which is called The War on Masculinity. The Toxic War on Masculinity. She cites some changes that happened, like specifically during the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
When the fathers left the home.
Mm.
And prior to that, they were with the family and the family was with them, working in the fields, doing the jobs around the house, working on the farm together, and that the children had their father's home.
Mm.
And their fathers helped the mothers with all the parenting. They were involved, involved together.
Or team. Yeah.
As a team, which biblically speaking, I mean, that's what the created order says, is that the male and female are meant to rule together, to help each other.
Yeah.
And that so much of some of the challenges we see, even in the realm of masculinity, started then at the Industrial Revolution, when the men left the home and the women sort of took on the parenting all by themselves and were more stressed and more strung out and, you know, all those things. And the men got disconnected from the children.
Mm-hmm.
And just all the outworkings of that are really fascinating and I never realized before. It's an entire book, so I recommend it. But it's just one aside as an example.
Yeah.